Welcome to another episode of the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about two of my favorite topics, AI, the obvious one, but also politics and maybe how the two things overlap. Jack, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. It's nice that we're back recording in the studio in the new year. Again, thanks to Vorboss. Shout out to Vorboss for setting us up and the great team here for sorting us out of the studio, making us look very professional, maybe more so than we deserve. But yeah, nice way to kick off 2025, being back in the studio. How are you? How was your Christmas and New Year?
It was good. I'm about 3 kilograms heavier and the camera adds about 10 kilograms. So I'm a whopping 120 kilograms right now. It's a lot. But yeah, it's good. I'm ready to be back. I'm ready to start talking absolute nonsense again and maybe kicking off the show by, going into how important politics is, how important technology is for politics and all this kind of stuff. I said it's two of my favorite topics. I do genuinely believe that, or do that is generally true, because politics influences absolutely everything. It's how our kind of lives are run, how our money's spent, the access to facilities we have. I think it's probably one of the most important things in people's lives day to day. I think a lot of people don't actually appreciate that around the world. And I also think that technology is playing such a huge role in politics, typically through information, maybe misinformation, through voting. Basically, I think it's technology has enabled, we live in a democracy, but democracies to flourish. And yeah, I'm really excited to kind of go into that and then eventually talk about one of the most cutting edge technologies that we have today, which is AI and how it's influencing all these things.
Yeah, 100%. I think I'm in a similar boat. I love technology, obviously. It's no surprise to anyone. And I am a follower of politics. And I when I was younger, we're getting on a bit now, Alec, right? We're getting on.
The wrinkles are showing in this 4K camera.
Well, we've realized how old we look on these cameras. And I was definitely more politically active and interested, when I was in university, for example. And I've kind of, partly, this kind of ties the two together, actually, because one of the big technological things that's changed in our lifetimes is our exposure to information generally. And as we'll get onto the history, but because we have so much exposure to social media, information being bombarded day to day, that's actually the reason I've become more politically disengaged. I've stopped following every development that's going on in politics. And I try and just get it a little bit more secondhand from a couple of, let's say, trusted sources or friends and family, that kind of thing, rather than having the constant notification. So it's an interesting way in for me, because actually my experience of politics has already changed in the last few years from technology.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, I find the political discourse online depressing a lot of the time. It's so polarizing. Yeah. And it's not just in politics, it's across like almost everything you can have an opinion on. Social media makes it polarizing. I read something recently, I'm going to talk about this guy, I think maybe multiple times, but a lot of this episode has actually been inspired in a lot of ways by a man called Yuval Noah Harari. Mm-hmm. You probably know him. He's the person that authored Sapiens, which is an incredible book, and more recently Nexus, which basically goes into the importance of information networks. And you kind of see the relation of that to politics. And yeah, a lot of this is inspired by him. But yeah, let's just go into it. Like I say, we live in a democracy, right?
We're both living newsflash.
Newsflash, yeah, in the UK. We live in democracy, crazy. Yeah. And Yuval kind of describes the setup for democracies. He's like, he kind of distills it in a really nice way. Mm. He's like, a democracy is a conversation. It's about multiple parties just having a conversation and agreeing to some outcome, many different outcomes in a lot of cases. Very different to dictatorship or authoritarian regimes. One person basically pushing everything to other people and saying, this is the decision, I'm going to do it, you action this. Whereas democracy is many people trying to come to some kind of consensus. Here we go, we've got a Web3 buzzword there we go. already. And he was like, well, back in the early days, it was very easy to do. 5 people, conversations easy. With 100 people, very easy. With a small village, easy. You can have this conversation. But when we start to go past the scale of, say, nation states, like Athens, ancient Greece, or kind of Athens, Sparta, all these kind of nation states within ancient Greece, say 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, it actually becomes quite difficult to have that conversation. How do you propagate information quickly enough, accurately enough between nation states across?
How do you scale it?
How do you scale it? Exactly. Yeah. The scalability question comes in. And how do you make sure that there's no problems in that scaling, the kind of comms that's going across? And he basically says to have democracies at the size we have now, say, you know, the UK, the US, all these kind of things, you need technology like the printing press, for example, to disseminate information efficiently, effectively, at scale, and in a trustworthy way.
Yeah, exactly. The printing press is a good one to bring in here, because when you think typically of how democracies change, right, with elections and things like that, then the amount of money that goes into campaigns advertising for different parties, different leaders of parties, etc., you see that the medium by which that advertising happens has obviously changed to keep pace with technology. So yeah, you initially had the printing press doing this stuff, you had radio, television, and now obviously in modern day we have kind of hinting towards the social media type stuff as well, which we'll come on to. But yeah, and it's interesting that technology has become not only part of the method of changing and evolving democracies, because again, you need technology to help scale things, right? That's why we're involving it. That's why we're able to have democracies operate on such a large scale. And you know, I don't know what you think. I subscribe to the Winston Churchill opinion of like, it's the democracy doesn't work, but it's the best we've got type thing, right? It's the best of the options available.
There's always going to be flaws in everything, right? And I think something that operates in this scale and is as impactful, as we've already said, politics is for people's everyday lives. There's always going to be people that may be left behind or disadvantaged in certain ways, especially when you're trying to manage 70 million people with a group of 200, 300 people at the center of it. But yeah, like we said, like, healthy democracies need communication to build consensus. And, you know, previously, say, predating the internet and social media companies specifically, we had newspapers, radio, television stations. So it was kind of like a few centralized parties in a way controlled the narrative.
And with big influences into each of them.
Exactly.
Well.
Yeah. Exactly. So on the one hand, that means there is this kind of this central point of accountability. You'd had ways to kind of, I guess, hold them accountable, to vet them potentially, to regulate them maybe. So you had, like, say, the Telegraph or these, like, the New York Times or whatever it is. But also, like you say, then because there's a few of these entities and they're kind of the gatekeepers in a way, maybe they were politically biased. Maybe they were influenced. Like, we can talk about many different newspapers in the UK, for example, that are left-wing, right-wing, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, I think there's pros, which are obviously there's a degree of accountability there because they're corporations, they're organizations, they have shareholders, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's probably maybe in a way easier to influence because there are only five big newspapers in the UK, for example, and they obviously have their bias. Everyone has their bias. And then, you know, social media kind of completely changed the game.
Yeah. And it's interesting because if you look at the kind of original promise and purpose of social media, it was framed around the language of politics. It was about democratization of freedom of speech, essentially, right? And being able to, and democratization of communication with one another, with connection, with sharing information, that kind of thing. So yeah, when was your first experience of social media? Because I think it must have been Facebook or maybe even something like MSN Messenger or something like that, right? Yeah. And, but that was, again, within our lifetimes, these platforms. And again, that's a word I want to highlight, right? We've moved from the corporation to the platform as being one of the major players in political discourse. But yeah, if you go back to the start, it was just this fun, cutesy, I would have been probably, well, I don't want to say anything that will say I violated terms of service, but I probably was about 12 or 13 when I was first using
cancelled.
When I was first using social media. And it was just very fun. You'd chat with your mates at school, maybe some family and friends and things, or if you wanted to add them, and then you had all the kind of mini games like Habbo Hotel or Farmville, right? That thing. It was a nice place to be, okay, and it was fun ultimately. And that's definitely, I don't think anyone describes social media as that in 2025.
Yeah, well, I had Bebo and MySpace back in the early days, where it was super simple, right? It was like, I think I got it in like 2008 or something like that. But it was kind of goes to this idea of like the web one, web two model. You're posting stuff, there's not much interaction. I think the reason it was so cutesy is because the people that were using it were kids, right? They were like late teenagers or early kind of 20s. I mean, in our case, maybe younger than that as well. So they were doing it to play games, to have fun, to talk to friends. Like, there was no kind of hidden agenda there. But as these people started to, you know, these kids grew up basically and started to understand the value of social media and connection, all this kind of stuff, and maybe became more political as part of that. And, you know, the numbers obviously skyrocketed to 5 billion, you know, social media users in 2023. All of a sudden, there was kind of more agenda there. There was actually, you know, even companies decided to say, well, actually, you know, we can start to influence these people. This is actually a voting power, all this kind of stuff. So maybe that's why it became a bit of a, well, a free-for-all and less kind of cutesy, funsy. There are a lot of pros, though. Let's not undermine the massive amount of advantages social media has created. Like, you get more sides to every story. It does really democratize. Anyone can be a newslet if they want to. Mm-hmm. So you get more sides to every argument, every kind of all the discourse. Also faster. I saw a thing on X recently where it was like a comparison of, say, X versus traditional news media outlets. Obviously, a traditional news media outlet has to be vetted, has to be, you know, printed, all this kind of stuff. So it takes a while to go through the process. It's kind of more centralized, right? Whereas I on my camera can film something and put it up instantly. So the time to actually get these news, these events online and into the kind of the sphere of influence is very short. So it's much faster.
Yeah, and I think that highlights the key point and transition from, again, the corporation to the platform as the source of news for people in general. Because again, news and politics are pretty much interchangeable as well, right? Politics follows the news follows politics, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, kind of in a circle. The way, yeah, as you said, corporations typically heavily regulated. You know, in the UK, you have something like Ofcom for regulating kind of TV and things like that. And the transition to platform has basically made, as you said, everyone an individual news outlet. And it's then the platform that may or may not have to be regulated, not necessarily the individual, right, who's a contributor. But there doesn't seem to be a huge, I mean, I'm not aware of the obligations of me. And no, again, no one's intentionally acting necessarily. Some people, okay, sure, journalists use it. People want to, highlight things that are happening. But they're not necessarily considering themselves as journalists. They're just individuals. They're observers, right, of the world they see.
Yeah.
But it can become news very quickly. You're right. The speed, and that's what we've seen, I think, probably happened around kind of 2014, 15, and onwards from there, is that it transitioned from the first port of call being the traditional news media outlets to social media. And now if I want to find something out, as bad as it is, I will go straight to X or something, right?
Yeah.
And then I'll go down the rabbit hole of, you know, a bunch of tweets I didn't want to see, but I will have seen what's actually happening.
And I think, like, to kind of bring that back to what was happening before, it's because we had these news articles like the Telegraph, whatever it is, and they were a bit more vetted, a bit more kind of institutional in a way. And you had this accountability, like they're regulated and all this kind of stuff. People trusted them, right? Mm. You see news, you see an article, you trust it. You think there's a degree of vetting. You think the information there is probably real and all this kind of stuff.
I actually have an anecdotal thing to say here. I am sure I've noticed a huge uptick in the number of spelling mistakes on BBC Sport in the last few years, right? And I think that's purely because they have the pressure
to get
things out faster. Because I used to read BBC Sport and I think this is very well written, very well vetted. Now it's like speed is the most important thing. And so I see mistakes in there, like, on a daily basis, which I never thought of before.
And let's not pretend that this was like a kind of a holy grail of, you know, information. Like, there was always bias there. All these kind of news outlets, whatever they are, printing presses, had bias. Everyone has bias. Everything's ever created has some form of bias.
For sure.
The main thing was about facts and, is it real? If, say, they give a stat that isn't true, for example, then there would be a degree of recourse that someone could say, well, you said this is true, correct it, blah, blah, blah. And they would have to do that. Like, Ofcom would make sure that they were regulated. Was it perfect? Yeah. No, but far better than, say, what we have now, where you still have the bias, probably much more bias, I guess, but also there's no easy kind of means or regulated means to actually hold things accountable, like facts accountable, like studies accountable, this kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's important to mention the word fact as well, right? Because there's an old adage, the lie is halfway around the world before the truth's got its trousers on.
Oh my God,
it's so true, because the truth is, it has more I don't want to use a Bitcoin analogy, but it's kind of like there's a proof of work to it. You have to authenticate and verify information before you put it out there. If you want to tell a lie, you haven't got to do any of that work. It's like a civil attack on information, right? So it's almost a feature of truth versus untruth that it travels faster. And then I guess that leads us on to what's happened with the algorithms, right?
Well, on that point, like I saw there's a study by MIT in 2022 that basically emphasizes that point. They found that false political news spread 6 times faster than factual news on X, largely due to algorithmic amplification. Wow, and now we're going to start to talk about the role of AIs and all this kind of stuff. Like we said, that, you know, news outlets, all this they have bias and they're producing things. And, you know, imagine if we had social media where everything's sequential. You follow 100 people, Jack posts at 10 a.m., someone else posts at 10:30 a.m., and it's just sequentially posted on my feed. But that's not how it works. Like, we have kind of touched on this a few times. We actually have algorithms in the background that are optimizing people's feeds, suggesting feeds, all this kind of stuff. And their whole goal is to basically maximize engagement, maximize, say, Jack or my time on the app. So the whole kind of goal for this AI algorithm, say, on a social media platform is to ensure that we spend the most amount of time on that platform as possible. Yep. And they don't really necessarily know exactly how they do it, the inner mechanics of this. It's basically go look at all the hundreds of millions of people that are using this, treat them as guinea pigs, A/B test on everything, work out what kind of information or what kind of things they want on their feed that will maximize their time on that platform, right? And what we kind of found out, to kind of, I guess, cut it short and give like the final result, is that AI algorithms discovered that the gold mine of human emotions, the human attention, were threefold: fear, hate, and greed. And it's not like people enjoy, you know, experiencing those emotions, but it makes you stay on the platform. It gains your attention.
Yeah, I just realized as you were saying that two of those horrible emotions are included in like the coin market cap index, the fear and greed index, right, for how the market's looking. Yeah, it's something that once you hear that finding, right, that observation about fear, hate, and greed being the main drivers of engagement, as soon as you hear it, you think, of course, it's obvious, it makes complete sense. But you know, it is something that 10 years ago we might not have known about ourselves, except, you know, people have now worked it out. And it's being, and I saw a really, really interesting video around Andrew Tate. Okay, it's not one of his videos. And I'm going to repeat this very sin I'm about to, you know, talk about now by saying this, but I think it's interesting. So they're basically saying that what people like Tate do is real trolling. And trolling, I don't know, I was literally yesterday years old when I found out that trolling isn't to do with cave trolls. It's to do with a method of fishing, right? So it's basically the method where you put bait out on the back of a trawler, I think.
Okay.
And you let the fish kind of follow the bait to a certain location. So that's where trolling actually comes from. And this is the mechanism they're using. Again, we'll link the video in the description maybe, but the idea that people are putting things out there like Tate that are deliberately incendiary, that is baiting people to engage.
That makes sense, the troll link to clickbait.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the bait is not to engage positively. It's to engage in it's trying to get people who disagree with him to voice that disagreement as vehemently as possible, to share it, to make reaction videos. So I know, again, I'm talking about him now, but just in the kind of meta context that people now farm for those precise emotions, and it is created, you know, Andrew Tate has become one of the most well-known people on the planet. And that's why, because people have kind of fallen for that trap.
And we're not like going to go into psychology and all this kind of stuff, but I kind of guess it goes to our base human instinct, right? It's like, that's what Yuval says in Sapiens, right? He talks about this, like, there's so much problems with like anxiety and depression, all this kind of stuff. At the end of the day, we are just programmed to survive. We're not programmed to be happy. So the things that charge us the most are the things that kind of could end that survival. The idea of like fear and hate and all this kind of, it's all very strongly linked to our core characteristics. And on that point, around, you know, emotionally charged content and all this kind of stuff, there was another study that showed that, you know, emotionally charged language, particularly fear, anger, and outrage and all this kind of stuff, is 70% more likely to be shared than neutral content. So yeah, it's probably the reason that, you know, there's so much crazy things online, yeah. because, you know, the one thing is we have these AI algorithms that are amplifying it because, you know, they don't look at it as a problem for humanity. All they want to do is optimize the amount of time spent on there. And then there's the whole thing around filtering. Should we filter this content, freedom of speech versus, you know, AI algorithms and what's positive for humanity? And this is a whole kind of, I guess this is a whole hot topic, hot potato that is constantly being talked about. And I guess we're going to talk a little bit about it now.
Yeah. And just while we touch on algorithms, because again, we want to disentangle algorithms from now AI and also those internal kind of instinctive impulses we have as humans. So what's actually happening under the hood at social media platforms is obviously they have these algorithms that determine how the platform works, right? It's not people manually working it out. You know, that's why we have the infinite scrolling timelines now, is they've worked out how to populate that timeline in a way that's going to keep us on there for longer. The algorithms you basically have, you have ranking algorithms, like the most famous one being Google's PageRank. But there are kind of other modifications of that, and different platforms use different ones. But that's what basically how you rank content on the platform. And then you have recommender algorithms, which basically pick a user. So say, you know, Twitter's looking at me or X is looking at me and saying, what does this guy want to see? Or really, what is this guy going to say? God, no. What is going to keep this guy on the platform longer, right? And so those are the kind of algorithms that are involved. Now you have, I just mentioned, Tate is hacking those algorithms by, you know, knowing potentially how they work and knowing that the psychological side that goes into them. So how things will be ranked. Well, if they're ranked by engagement, what gets the most engagement has to be that thing. Then you also have those recommender systems that are talking, you know, directly to me and saying, what do I want? That might be taking information from many, many different sources, right? This is what we talked about, the whole data brokers. This is the, you know, is Siri listening to me in the background all the time? Why am I getting advertised Adidas shoes because I mentioned Adidas to my friend, right? It's that kind of stuff. So there's lots of different inputs that can go to these algorithms as well. And this is all before the advent of proper, the scary kind of advent of AI in this context as well.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions, like recycling, at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show. I think that the, like, not the problem, but the kind of the issues that people are starting to highlight is, one, like the user retention, like what is negative content? And again, all of this is so subjective. What is negative content? What's good? What's bad? So we're not going to give an opinion on that stuff. But some people are now saying that one of the problems is that a lot of negative content is being promoted on these things, because not because of the freedom of speech stuff. Like if you just say everyone has absolute right to say whatever they want on the platform, but purely because of the algorithm that Jack just spoke about being highlighted, being pushed to the forefront because it is clickbaity, because it's kind of touching on those fear receptors. That's the one part. The other part is the lack of transparency. Like you kind of said there that maybe the Andrew Tates of the world have worked out what is the thing that's going to the top of the feed, but we don't actually know, right? And I think some of the times, I guess they have data, but I guess even the corporations that are running these things don't necessarily know.
Yeah.
They've gone on and said, you maximize engagement, put the posts that will make Jack stay on the algorithm, stay on the platform for as long as possible. And they have so many data points that it's really hard for them to work out why something is being recommended. They can probably work it out through data and show some things, but really it's very hard to keep up with. And they're the two big problems, lack of transparency and what is actually being promoted may be negative.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really interesting aspect to this is the fact that, you know, maybe the platforms don't even know. Maybe now AI is starting to do some of the recommendation algorithm itself, right? Or is starting to inform how the algorithms are built even. We don't quite know. I mean, I know X, when it was taken over, they kind of open sourced some aspects of the of their algorithms, right? They did expose some of the logic, but not all of it. These are not open source by any means, because these algorithms are both built upon and contribute to what is arguably the largest source of value for these companies, which is that their data sets, right? Mm. Their data sets of that, not just the content itself, but also the user behavior and the interactions between people, right? So those, they're not going to expose how they're using those data sets. They're not going to expose, you know, they might, even if they expose some of the algorithm, they're not going to give us that raw data that's telling us how it works. It's the secret sauce, right? It's the secret sauce, 100%.
Same with TikTok. Like that had, like, I think maybe the best algorithm for getting people absolutely fixated. Mm. I remember seeing, like, without going into the numbers, it like took the most amount of data of any app. I remember someone saying they went into it and saw that TikTok was taking so much data from across all your different apps, all your different mobile devices. And again, I don't know whether this is BS or not, but that was one of the reasons why they think that TikTok has been removed, because it was taking too much data and had too much information that was being exported to the company. But with all that data, it made it extremely sticky. It made it extremely addictive for users. So like we said, we have these algorithms that are working on, say working, like we're starting to humanize them, even in our language. We have these algorithms that have been set up by, say, the social media giants of the world, mm-hmm. and they act as the gatekeepers. They're effectively determining what is seen, what is heard, what is prioritized. They're the kingmakers of the digital age. And like we said, the reason this overlaps with politics so much is because information and good information is basically what enables democracies to kind of work successfully, flourish. Like, it's a conversation. And if we have bad information or untrue information being propagated, whatever, then democracies can't necessarily succeed. Like I said, another kind of way to think about this is, you know, back in the olden times, we didn't know where our food was coming from. So we're kind of genetically programmed to just eat as much food as we want whenever we can and we'll be fine, right? All of a sudden, we have a lot of junk food coming into the world, lots of high fats, all this kind of stuff. Mm. So that genetic programming, if we kind of like dive into it, will mean that we get obese, we eat too much junk food, and that's bad. It's kind of the same with information.
Yeah,
we don't need all this junky information constantly being spammed to kill our serotonin and all this kind of stuff. What we need is good, healthy information. And this is kind of where we get into the realm of what is the role of a social media company in monitoring, managing, and maybe even preventing information from getting through? Like, should they be just an open source, anyone can say whatever they want, or should they start to filter things? And we've seen, say, Facebook used AI to downrank what they considered COVID-19 misinformation. We have community notes on X, for example. Yep. These are all solutions that have been implemented to try and reduce the amount of misinformation.
Yeah, and I think when we're talking about politics specifically, I think most people would point back to, you know, a very significant event involving the UK and Europe in 2016, mm-hmm. where, you know, the Cambridge Analytica scandal came out and everyone found out, okay, that I think that we don't know if that's the first instance of this happening, but it was the time that everyone realized, okay, political information is now, or social media is now being used as a primary way to influence elections, which is not necessarily a statement about malicious intent. That's just, it could be for advertising, right? But people were using it seriously to win elections one way or the other. But it was also the time that people realized that, okay, and you can abuse this power and you can abuse these systems very, very heavily to influence unduly elections beyond those. So we said the regulations on the media.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you also have regulations on political parties in terms of donation, campaign spending, and that kind of thing. And that maybe these were being subverted as well via social media and targeting and things like that. So I think that, you know, that's 2016. Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago now, right? It's a shockingly long time ago. Actually, it doesn't feel that long. That's one of the first times people thought, okay, these are big issues just purely with social media. And for me, when you're talking about free speech and its impact on things like elections, I don't have a fully formed opinion yet on how, and it's a very difficult problem to solve. But my opinion is that when platforms use algorithms to decide what's on the feed, that's when it ceases to be a forum for pure kind of free speech, right? And it becomes more like a product, right? That they're producing this feed as a product for you, because free speech, in my mind, almost makes sense in a public forum. You're free to go outside and say what you want, more or less. Yeah. that's a whole other discussion. And we did have forums on the internet. We do have forums on the internet, which are kind of unmoderated to a large degree, but, you know, less and less. And we've moved from that forum model where free speech has a direct analogy and just saying something into the open air.
Yeah.
To this platform model where everything is being said, but through this filter of a product, filter of a platform. And then the question is, well, what are their responsibilities? I personally, you know, I'm a big believer in free speech, but I equally am a strong proponent that I don't think I think that it's perfectly fine for platforms to have terms of service and to potentially censor things on their own terms, because they're not necessarily there to provide a public forum. And that's the distinction. I think too many social media platforms have been trying to have their cake and eat it by pretending they're a public forum, but without actually operating as one.
Yeah. And I guess it's kind of like tricky. It's like, what is their responsibility? At the end of the day, these are private companies, right?
Yeah.
They are products. Like, we should always think of them, in my mind, as products. Like, who is a government to say you need to meet these standards in this, in what a lot of ways is a private network of your users, right? Is it a public forum? Is it a basic human right? And that's kind of the conversation we're starting to move towards, is actually a lot of people are starting to consider these as basic human rights. And all of a sudden, then they're held to a higher degree of accountability than it would if it was a private product and private operation. And you're no longer just accountable to your shareholders. You're also accountable to governments and things like this. And that kind of the line is quite gray on what are their responsibilities, right? And like you say, they've been having their cake and eating it, saying, you know, there's been a transition over the last like few years to say, okay, we've banned lots of what we consider undesirables, or governments would consider undesirables. But I don't agree with that. I actually don't think people should have been banned. I think they say everyone has a right to freedom of speech. Mm. I think the problem isn't around, you know, do people have the right to freedom of speech? It's this problem with filter. Like you say, what's being prioritized? Like, it's not freedom of speech if, say, someone who's saying one thing gets, you know, times one views, and someone is saying another thing is getting times 10 views.
Exactly. It's like saying you're free to speak in this empty room over here versus you're free to speak to this hall full of people.
Exactly. Yeah. So if we agree on that, then the question becomes, how do we filter? Because it's clear there needs to be some filter. And like, Blue Sky has kind of started to get around this with having like, well, one option is to have just sequential feeds or whatever. I just follow 10 people and the only things I see is those 10 people. Now, obviously, there's going to be an effect there on user engagement. Like, it doesn't trigger those hate receptors or whatever. But is that a better way to do it? Like, unsure. I think the how to filter, I think we agree that the filter needs to be more transparent, adapted. Mm-hmm. But the how to filter is much more ambiguous and subjective and difficult to kind of get our head around. There's no way some regulator is going to come in and be like, these are the standards, do this. Like, that just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and I think one thing I wanted to pick up there particularly is you mentioning it was going to be about the kind of global nature of all of these social media platforms and how you comply with a million different rule sets in a million different countries. It blows my mind that people like Meta, people like Google are even able to comply with, you know, GDPR in the in Europe at the same time as they are, you know, different data regulation in different countries. They have to, again, this is where technology kind of comes to the aid and to save the day for politics and information in general, because they have found ways to, you know, create these incredible centralized but distributed systems that serve different views of the content to people in different countries that, in theory, I haven't vetted it myself, but in theory, obey and abide by the local jurisdiction laws, right? Because people take it very seriously. If you're a big company, if you're a publicly traded tech company in Silicon Valley or something, you've definitely got a big compliance team who's working on making sure that you are obeying these rules. And for me, it blows my mind that it even happens, right? Yeah. That they're even able to solve these problems. And it is all with these incredible distributed systems and database technology that, you know, goes a little bit above my head sometimes. But yeah, I just wanted to pick up on that point, because we're just talking about another, it's very similar to data privacy. It's just about freedom of speech law. It's a different type of law. It's a different type of regulation that is jurisdiction specific, that the problem is much less clear, right? I think in how these platforms should be treated, and everyone's starting to get an opinion now.
Yeah.
Lots of countries are starting to say, well, X should be a public forum, or X should be a private platform with terms of service that can or cannot be violated, and therefore, you know, kicked off the platform, that kind of thing. So, but everyone's disagreeing with it, and how they respond is different. Yeah,
and I think I don't want to go too much into this because it kind of gets into the whole realm of like conspiracy theories and all this kind of stuff. But I think a big thing is, like we say, we know that social media filters and what's being put to the top of someone's feed has a big impact on what they see, which is their opinion, which then affects how they vote and what happens in the country, right? And then all of a sudden you start to have, say, foreign actors that will influence potentially those feeds to get to gain over, say, political opponents, whatever. And this has been something that's started to be highlighted by, you know, actual studies. I think Microsoft did a massive one about the number of bots that some countries were using to, say, manipulate elections. And all of a sudden then you say, okay, so how do we start to control these or whatever? And should they control these? Are they private companies? Whatever, whatever, whatever. But yeah, I guess the question is, what do we do? Like, it's tricky. It really is tricky. And I think this, it kind of gets into the realm of like having accountable AI to, you know, readable AI, AI that is understandable. And on the one hand, one thing I think that should be offered is this, something that's been pushed by Blue Sky, for example, is the idea of algorithmic choice. You go in as a user and you can select, say, what kind of content you want, how things are prioritized, what kind of feeds you have, rather than the system we have right now, which is just a bit of a black box and it's kind of default and it will just prioritize the things that keep you glued to the screen for as long as possible.
Yeah, I think it's a nice kind of initial step. The problem for me is that, okay, also unless you get big adoption of these kind of Blue Sky like social networks, then we haven't solved the problem. But also the what the major social media platforms do currently and those algorithms, again, we said at the start, they provide a really good experience, right? It's an experience that we seem to want to have and to enjoy and is incredibly quick and gets us all the information very quickly, as well as all the memes and everything. It does it very well. And if you look at something like Blue Sky right now, the alternative is relatively primitive, right? So it's not going to replicate necessarily that experience right away. It might do in the future, but also you need literacy about things like LLMs or algorithms themselves. And no one's going to be able to parse them. Like, most people who use Blue Sky will not be able to parse and understand what the algorithm they even choose is doing. They can understand the high-level description, but they can't verify it themselves, right? And there's that separation of trust. But we have that in the banking system, right? When when we use mobile internet banking, right? There's always going to be that, and I don't have an issue with that. One thing I just wanted to mention while we're talking about AI, though, is it just crossed my mind as we were preparing for this episode that, again, everything we've just said, more or less, in the last half an hour could have been just directed at social media platforms and algorithms, which are not necessarily AI. Now we've got really, really good generative AI, and we've got great models behind them. And, you know, it's not just going to be LLMs in the future. There's going to be extrapolations of this, you know, from AI agents to things that are not just about, you know, generating content, but, you know, purely decision-making engines. I'm interested in wondering if we have these platforms currently experimenting with them, maybe they're building AI into, you know, they're asking an AI to write the next algorithm, right? If they have them doing that and they're giving them all the data sets, are these AI algorithms just going to spit out things that are like optimized versions that have learned from the very worst traits of what's been happening, right? So if you take an AI now and it looks at Twitter or looks at X and you say, write me a really performant algorithm to recommend content and retain people better, it's probably going to take those things that Yuval Noah Harari has identified about them, maybe identify sweet spots for them and make it that much worse. So I'm wondering if like it's gonna kind of be a negative feedback loop of the worst, right? The worst feeds the worst, and AI helps us do that. That was something that crossed my mind that I hadn't thought about before, and I'm quite worried about.
Well, it's interesting. I know the term that's being used constantly is AI agents and what role will they play and all this kind of stuff. And there's a Black Mirror episode kind of related to this, the idea of this cartoon character style person getting elected. And a lot of the stuff there is promoting fear, greed, like these negative emotions that we said are kind of like stimulating to humans. And like you say, if an AI agent, it's not too crazy to think of in 50 to 100 years time, the idea of an AI agent being potentially a political figure that is based on all this information, knows that the things that humans are currently responding to based on social media a negative fear, hate, all this kind of stuff. And what kind of world do we live in where that is the foremost driver of political discourse? A scary world, I guess. And then it's kind of like, I've seen this often touted as like the thing to do. AI's obviously has got a lot of scary things, a lot of good things. What we need to make sure is the good guys have the best AI. And then he brings into question, what is good, what is bad? Like, you don't really know. I'm not really sure what the answer is, to be honest. No, it is scary. Like, as AI agents are built on more and more data, publicly available data, that will be social media data. And like we're saying right now, the things that are prioritized on social media feeds, which makes up probably the 90% of things on there, are based on those negative receptors that we've talked about already.
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess we're looking now, what is the path forward, right? How do we operate in this new regime where we have big social media platforms that are being operated in a more kind of Wild West way than ever before, potentially. Yeah. We have algorithms that have been building and learning how to control what we see for years and how to put us in silos or show us what we need to for years or dominate certain discourses in politics and things. And now we have ever improving AI, right? So what's the path forward? And yeah, I do not have a good answer. I think it's really refreshing, actually, to sometimes just not have a strong opinion on something. And in a world where ChatGPT can give you an answer for any question you've got, then you may as well just, you know, that's what you can do as a human. What is to err is human.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so to just be like, you know, as they do in the world.
And even like the quality of the misinformation, like the, you know, we talked about like deep fakes and completely changing like our ability to verify what is real, what is not real.
Yeah.
Like that. It's had an effect already and it's going to continue to have an effect. I think that maybe getting back to some kind of like trusted route of things, like I think there is like an optimum in between the previous idea of like centralized news outlets and all this kind of stuff and verified content and what we have now is anyone can say anything. I think there is kind of a middle ground where, but a lot of this comes down to education, right? You teach people what AI can do, teach people how social media algorithms work. Like, again, that comes into transparency. We need to know how they work. We need to have more kind of transparency in how they work. And then teach people the pros and cons of these. So hopefully people can actually understand what the good is, what the bad is, and come to their own decision in a healthier manner than what we've got now. And I started to see this. There's a lot of initiatives in, obviously, it's always Scandinavia. I think it's in Finland, where
10, 15 years
rather than right now, our kind of education system is breaking down, being like, AI is going to revolutionize everything, destroy education system, blah, blah, blah. What they're doing is teaching people the pros and cons, how you can use it, what some of the downsides are, and trying to help them come to a middle ground where it's like, actually, I need to be able to verify content because it's so easy to spin up whatever I want and it might not always be true.
Yeah, I 100% agree. A lot of this is beyond, obviously, regulation and arming the good guys with the good AI, whatever that means, as you said. Education is huge. And I don't think it's, I 100% agree with you in educating on LLMs, digital literacy, all this stuff is huge. But I think one of the most important things you can do now is just to focus on education around just critical thinking skills, right? I've always thought one of the most valuable things I've ever been taught or one of the most valuable courses I've ever had was like my school history classes, right? Like GCSE, A-level.
That's true.
Because one of the big components is like these source papers and 100%. You have to critically analyze.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, what was the situation in Germany in 1940? But they give you primary sources, secondary sources, tertiary sources. You learn about how to come to a conclusion based on the fact that there are many different opinions, many different agendas at play in telling a story. And I think everyone should know those. Everyone should just be made aware of the fact that a story can be spun up for you based on any number of competing interests, right? And that's all you really need to know. Just be skeptical, I think. Just that, if that's my take home message to the audience, right? Is just always approach things with maximum skepticism and have a high bar for being convinced by them.
100%. I think everything's a data point at the end of the day, and some should have more weighting than others, but don't let social media or AI dictate those weightings for you. You've got to come up with your own weightings and take them as data points, basically. But yeah, I guess it's not all doom and gloom. I think I am very optimistic for the future if the good AI
is
winning,
the last basically. 45 minutes.
But yeah, I think, like I say, politics in my mind is one of the most important subjects or one of the most important realms that everyone should be interested in. And I think social media and AI and the AI algorithms that control social media is also an absolute huge topic. I think the overlap of these two things is extremely kind of important and weighted, and people should be aware of what's going on underneath the surface and maybe vet everything they read and don't trust anything, even what we say. Don't trust what we say,
or better yet, just switch it all off once in a while. That's my advice.
Digital detox. But yeah, this has been a fun episode. I guess we'll talk about this a lot more because this is a constantly fluxing and evolving subject. Thank you for listening wherever you may be, and join us next time to untangle a little more of Web3. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.